Good morning, everyone. Here we are in Toronto. It's Friday, November 14th, and this is the Big COC podcast. I'm here with three people who have all been on the podcast before, a couple people who haven't been here for a while, so it's great to have them back. First of all, I'm going to welcome back Paula Citron. How are you, Paula?
I'm fine, thank you.
Great to have you back. Just reminding our listeners, Paula, of course, is a well-known Toronto arts journalist, broadcaster, and critic. She's senior dance writer for the Globe and Mail. And her blog is paulacitron.ca, where you can check out all the stuff she's seeing, because she's everywhere all the time, it seems. Also returning is Wayne Gooding. Hi, Wayne.
How are you?
Good, good. Good to have you back. Wayne, of course, is editor of Opera Canada magazine. He's on our COC Speakers Bureau. He's also does chats for us at the North York Central Library. And next week we have... What do we have next week?
We have a talk on Director's Theatre and Don Giovanni. So we're going to look at the first night of Don Giovanni in Prague, and then another production at the turn of the 20th century, and then the one that's coming to the COC in Jan-Feb, the Dmitry Chernyakhov production.
That, I think, will be wonderful. And yeah, the whole series of opera talks this year, the theme is... Director's Theatre,
we're doing it as a what do I call it, first nights, folk traditions, and fresh starts.
Right.
An exploration of director's theatre through opera's most dysfunctional families.
I think it's a great theme, and we're kind of focusing on it this year. We have an opera exchange coming in January as well, and that will be the focus of that afternoon. And not last but not least, I want to welcome back John Jilks. How you doing, John?
Not bad at all. Thanks for your mock-up.
Great. And John, of course, is the author of operaramblings.wordpress.com, a blog that covers a variety of operatic and vocal concerts that happen around Toronto. So I thought we would start, maybe this can become a new feature. I don't know. We're all seeing stuff all the time, and I know a couple of people wouldn't mind chatting about some of the recent productions they've seen. And already on the podcast, we talked about, of course, the death of Klinghoffer showing at the Met and all the controversy around it, the protests. But it struck me that we actually probably haven't talked about the opera itself very much. And we're lucky that Wayne was just in New York this week. When did you see Klinghoffer?
I saw it just a few days ago.
Okay.
I think I was seeing the fourth performance or the fifth performance
right.
in the run.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I was there for 2 days because there was an opportunity I couldn't pass up, first of all, to see Shostakovich's Lady Macbeth at Mtsensk, which is an opera I really like,
mm-hmm.
and then the next night, The Death of Klinghoffer by John Adams, and this is one I had not seen before, and I like Adams's music. I very much like Nixon in China, and Dr. Atomic too, though a little less so, but so I was very keen to see Klinghoffer, and I guess I would have been satisfied maybe to go see it in the movie, except of course the movie and all broadcast of it got cut, and so the only way to see it was to go see it on the stage. And I should say, first of all, that the protests, I think, were only there for opening night.
Yeah.
There was no sign of protest inside or outside the Met on the night I saw it earlier this week, except for someone who was handing out leaflets to explain what really happened. But it was a very level-headed leaflet. But I have to say, I was disappointed. I came out of the theater wanting to have enjoyed it and liked it much more than I actually did, and it puzzled me as to what was not working with this one. And it occurs to me, frankly, in the aftermath, that actually it has better music than it comes across as an opera, because it's actually very unlike any, well, certainly the other two big John Adams operas that I have seen. And I think what bothered me about it, it has a very good staging by Mark Morris, a British director, theatre director. He's artistic director of the Bristol Old Vic. And listeners may know his work if they saw War Horse on its extensive tour through North America. That was his production in England and the North American version as well. And it was very well staged. Klinghoffer was extremely well staged, very kinetic and so on. I think in the end what's bothersome about it is the libretto by Alice Goodman, which is so poetic that it becomes almost anti-theatrical, and I think this is what I was trying to get at. It's interesting that Kling Offer is actually structured rather like a Bach Passion. There are all these big choruses and then episodes in between of narrative in between by various characters. And the choruses, and indeed the text for the characters, is very dense. It's full of imagery that really you have to think about very hard just to sort of get the illusions and so on. And all of that works against, to my mind anyway, works against the piece as a theatrical presentation. Mm. The drama of it really didn't come across to me. There are some very fine parts to it. But as a whole, I thought it was very unsuccessful as an opera on the stage. And what I would actually, one of the first things I did after I came back was actually buy a recording of it, which I didn't have, because I really do want to listen to it again and forget the stage part of it and listen to it as you might listen to an oratorio or something, because I really do think there's more to it than I sensed on inside the theatre. Right. So it was an unexpected reaction, actually. Mm-hmm. I've heard bits of it before, but I've never, certainly not seen it on the stage. It doesn't have anything like the engaging narrative of Nixon, that Nixon does, and then, as I say, Dr. Atomic, I think, does for most part, but not all the way through.
Yeah. Can somebody help me out? I have seen this opera.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot for the life of me remember where. Was it San Francisco? Was it Santa Fe?
You could have seen it in San Francisco. Okay, you could have seen it in, I'm not sure about Santa Fe.
Wayne's got a list of the
I have a list
history.
Because it's very interesting.
You played in Brooklyn.
You could have seen it at the Brooklyn Academy of Music.
Right.
And even Juilliard actually has done a version of it.
When I saw it many years ago, there was no controversy. You just went to the opera, it was a new opera, and you saw it, and so I remember it as the main component of this opera was the conversation between Marilyn Klinghoffer and the chief terrorist.
No, there is not.
They never meet.
They don't meet.
No, on different parts of the stage, but my memory is clearly faulty.
There are really two major set pieces for Marilyn. One of them is actually after he has been murdered, but she doesn't know at this point. She's with the captain. The main interchange is between her and the captain.
Okay, so it's not the terrorist, it's her and the captain.
And the captain.
Because
and that's where she
that
hints that
the...
she is being, that she has a medical condition. And in fact, she died of cancer 4 months after the real events. And then she comes back at the end, she has the last word again with the captain.
All right.
In which she, you know, really it's one of the most emotional parts of it, is where she really expresses, she knows now that her husband has been murdered.
So that's my faulty memory, because this was many, many years ago.
But I remember that
it's her and the captain that
yes.
was the central
the captain,
part of it. And I didn't find anything about it that would be, controversial.
Well, it's
and
interesting.
And that's why I had real trouble understanding.
Well, this is a co-production of English National Opera, and it was done at English National Opera without any real problems. As I look at my list here, it's been done 5 times in New York now by various institutions. Wow. And this was the first one that really... and perhaps because it's the most prominent company, obviously, with the Metropolitan, which was the first one, as far as I know, that it had been... the controversy.
Now, John, you've seen the...
I've seen the film.
The
Benny Wilcock film,
that's right,
rather than the stage version, which is a little tighter.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Considerably shorter and more naturalistic because it's filmed on location. It's actually filmed mostly on a cruise ship. And a lot of the pieces that are staged as dance in the stage production, like the chorus of the exiled Palestinians and the chorus of the exiled Jews, played over documentary footage, which is very intense.
Yeah.
Very intense indeed. I mean, on the one hand, you've got displaced Jews somewhere in Central Europe, you know, late 1945. On the other hand, you've got Haganah driving Palestinians out of their homes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty visceral. But just coming back to the protest thing, I think the reason there were protests this time is because the discourse about Israel and Palestinians has shifted in the United States. It's shifted wildly to the Zionist right. Mm-hmm. And it's now at the point where the protesters, who were closely aligned with the settler movement and their newspapers in Israel, are basically trying to shut down a kind of discourse that presents the Palestinians as people.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem with Klinghoffer is not that it glorifies terrorism, but it treats the Palestinians as people with a history. And that's no longer permissible in the mainstream US discourse,
yeah.
in my view.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you. I mean, I think that is the problem with it now. It's very, I mean, the piece itself is even-handed to a fault, actually.
To a fault.
It really is. I mean, it really bends over backwards to, yeah. as John says, treat both sides as people.
And I think that's
there's
why it's
a,
not
you know, there's a discussion of atrocities committed by both sides. I mean,
yeah.
it really is very even. I mean, anti-Semitism is certainly represented in it, you know, in the stage, but it is not an anti-Semitic piece by any stretch.
The other thing that was said in some of the critiques, the one critique I found really interesting was because the UK Guardian took five people from different cultural backgrounds to see it and got their reactions. And the one that really interested me was the reaction of the Palestinian. And he said his problem with Klinghoffer was that it turned the Middle East situation, for want of a better phrase, into a dispute between Jews and Muslims. Which as a Christian Arab, he found deeply disturbing because he because this is a dispute between Zionists and Palestinians fundamentally, not between Jews and Muslims. I mean, I'm sure we all. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective that possibly goes some way towards explaining why it doesn't come off as theater. I mean, one thing that people forget. Is that the hijackers were from the PFLP, if I'm correct, which is a Marxist-Leninist organization, not an Islamic organization at all. I think some of what the opera is trying to say has been kind of distorted and caught up with the way that the dialogue about what's happening and the reality of what's happening in the Middle East has changed. Not just since the hijacking of the Kililoro, but since Death of Klinghoffer was written. And we're trying to reinterpret the opera in terms of, you know, Israel versus Hamas, which is not the world that Klinghoffer is depicting.
I mean, this is an opera that is now approaching 25 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, and, you know, one thing that did strike me, we didn't... There's a lot of video in the production, but it tends to be impressionist with seawater and this kind of thing. There wasn't the kind of video that obviously is in the movie that you're talking about. But I mean, at times, you know, with benefit of hindsight and what's going on right now in the Middle East and our involvement in that, I mean, it seemed almost like dated history. It seemed sort of something from the past.
Yes.
But yes, I think in the protest, the sensibilities that were being brought to bear were current, you know, 2014 sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell, the protest really only lasted on opening night. Because, as I say, on this week, on November the 10th, which was, 11th rather, which was when I saw it, I mean, there was no protest outside, there was no protest inside.
Mm-hmm.
And the theater was full. I mean,
I heard it's doing very well. Yeah.
And I think part of that is, of course, the you know, the buzz factor that comes out of the controversy.
Well, that was
place.
Inevitable, I think. I think out of all this, we're probably going to have to move on a bit now. But you know, the real big shame is that the world didn't get to see this opera to make up their own minds.
Yeah,
I mean, that's
no,
been said
I
before,
think
but
that's hugely regrettable.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
And I. Frankly, now I've seen it in the theater and not particularly, you know, engaged with it. I wish I could see it in the cinema, and I'll certainly make a point of trying to see the movie that was made. It's a British movie, if I recall.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's basically...
It's available on DVD.
It's available on DVD.
Yeah.
I mean, it's E&O regulars. It's like Tom Randall and Chris Maltman and that guy.
Yeah.
Well, on a... on a different note, Paula saw something recently here in Toronto, a different kind of opera presentation, and I know she wants to tell us a little bit about it, and I'm curious to know, I think we all are, what this is.
All right, this is Opera Luminata, which is a Toronto-based organization. This show was not, these sets of performances were not the first. They've done it, they sold out in the Living Arts Center in Mississauga, Brampton, Markham, like if you went the swing of the 905s, they've done quite a lot of these performances, and there's many to follow. So what it is there's a couple, Ray Brazo, who is the producer, and his wife, Shoshana Friedman, who is a soprano. And they have put this together with the help of the director, Michael McLennan. And what it does is turn each of these arias and or chorus numbers into a little mini production. And so you get this sweep of not just singing, but singing with a purpose within each of these little arias. But the big deal is where it is the most effective, there are pyrotechnics.
Is this indoors or outdoors?
It is indoors.
Oh,
and Ray Brazeau, the producer, is one of the great pyrotechnicians of Canada, who's done it for U2, which is a rock group, and some others. So he's very famous. So what you and also Shoshana Friedman and Ray Brazeau pick up wherever they can vintage haute couture ball gowns. So this is not your average recital dress, which, I mean, let's face it, opera singers don't have a lot of taste when it comes to dresses. If
some would differ with that, I think.
You know, well,
the Renee Flemings of this world.
Oh, but they've got the money to go
Oscar
de La Renta.
No, I know what
Oscar
you're
de La Renta or whatever. But these, the first thing I noticed was just how glamorous these people look. There's 16 of them. There's four leads, two feature singers who get a couple of numbers each, and then there's the 12-member chorus, 6 and 6. And when you read through their credentials, a lot of them, the chorus members, are very recent graduates of opera schools or still in opera schools. And there was some really decent singing going on. I'll get to the leads in a minute. But I have to say, on some utterly perverse level, I enjoyed this enormously because I never knew where the pyrotechnics were going to come and where they were going to be used. Like in one of the arias that deal with the devil, the singer was orchestrating with his hands various pyrotechnics going off. Or walking upstage at the end of Nessun Dorma, and which was one of the few war horses. So the repertoire was not your usual one. And the pyrotechnics go off, and he's walking upstage with his arms upstretched into the arms of the fireworks. Mm-hmm. There was a lot to look at between these unbelievably gorgeous dresses, vintage, right from the 1930s to the 1950s and 60s. Beautiful ball that could have made any red carpet. I mean, I couldn't believe how glamorous everybody mm-hmm. looked. And the men had, it just to get the men more colorful, they had colorful vests and matching bow ties. I mean, it was a glamorous event. And also, you're dealing with the only thing I can call it is karaoke opera, because you've got the score, like there isn't a live orchestra. So you've got the music coming through the sound system, and everybody was radio mic'd. And it's to make opera fun and attract a wide audience. Now, the night I attended, which was the Tuesday night, the day after it opened, the audience was not particularly large, and they were hoping it was going to build, but they felt, to give themselves credibility, they had to have a Toronto show. So they were at the Fleck Dance Theatre for almost a week, and this is a prestige venue. And I was surprised. So there's obviously fairly big bucks going on here, but it's designed for everybody to have a good time. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, you know, I'm having a good time. Because McLennan, the director, really did attempt to make every aria into a ensemble number. Like, for example, for the Toreador song, the women and the men of the chorus come out, but the women are sort of oohing and aahing over the Toreador, and their bows are trying to keep them away. And on the other hand, in the second act, when you get Carmen, it's the men that are drooling and their women that are trying to keep them apart. So It's they ignored the context that are in like the actual opera for the most part. And you had this, I don't know, Cirque du Soleil of opera, but it's been wildly popular in the burbs. And who knows, it might even catch on in Toronto. I mean, it's got a long history. It's not like a fly-by-night. And it was extremely slick. So, I mean, just to talk about the singing, Shoshana Friedman, Jennifer Elisabetta Centroni, Pablo Benitez, and Marco Petrocchi. And Petrocchi was the only one I knew, mostly from opera and concerts. He's the baritone. And I found him quite breathy and on the lighter side. Shoshana Friedman, who was also the music director, she can certainly sing. I mean, has anyone ever heard of her or known of her? But she really, and I'll tell you, every single one of these people, where necessary, went for the high note and the money note and made it. So they all had upper registers of some sort. The best singing for me was Pablo Benitez, a tenor born in Colombia, I guess. And he, I just
only
don't...
Only meeting on high note, doesn't it?
Yeah, no. But he had beautiful legato phrasing and almost too much of an Italian at Saab. And I'm wondering, why doesn't this guy have a bigger career? Like, why have I never heard of him before? Because he could sing and do a very good job. And he was also a good actor. If I had had my eyes closed, when Jennifer Elisabetta Citroni, the mezzo, first started to sing, I would have thought that she was an older contralto. It was that kind of enormous voice, mm-hmm. with a top and a bottom. I couldn't believe that this young woman had this unbelievable voice. It was staggering. So I was seeing a whole bunch of people I'd never heard of before. For the most part, the singing was, you know, fairly decent, in some cases very good. And my feeling was, well, I wish these people luck if it means that more people are going to come to opera.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's interesting because it does seem to be, in a way, part of, you know, a whole movement that we've talked about a few times on here already of all these different companies that are popping up. We were at a recital last night at the Extension Room just down the street here with Tia Cesaroni and Adrian Kramer, who used to be in the ensemble here. Jennifer Nichols, the dancer, and I can't remember the other dancer's name.
Oh, it's her partner, Sebastian de something or other.
Yeah, sorry. But anyway, it was interesting. I mean, it was like a combination of dance, singing, there were visuals. Just, you know, I mean, we'll no doubt talk more about this. We've got Uncle John coming up, which is the mm-hmm. Against the Grain's version of Don Giovanni, coming up in December at the Black Box Theater on Queen Street. West and
well,
you know, on and on.
Well, yeah, I mean, I saw another show that I think is worthy of mention just a couple of weeks ago at the University of Toronto. Tim Albury staged a show. It's not an opera. It's basically art songs arranged and staged from before the First World War through the First World War to the aftermath of the First World War. The show is called Last Days. It was a real emotional roller coaster, beautifully staged, very well sung, very cleverly done, some amazing emotional, what's the right word, pulls. There was a piece with lyrics by Bobo about the devastation of France in 1914, and then go straight from that into Ives, He Was There, which is lyrics by John McCrae, and it's the most jingoistic, horrible piece you'll ever hear in your life. And then straight from that into some Butterworth, and you know, it was really very well done, quite decent singing. Anybody who's going to center stage will get to hear the star of that show, which is the tenor Charles Sy, who's
he's one of our finalists
at
ensemble competition.
And he's impressed me on a number of occasions now, and there was some very, it was a very good young soprano, whose name is escaping me, and some very good singing all around. The whole thing was staged in the round in the Hart House music room, so with about maybe 60 or 70 people just ranged in a single row of chairs around the outside of Hart House. There were maybe three or four performances, so again, great piece of music theater, which only a couple of hundred people probably got to see, which is kind of unfortunate.
Well, I think this will actually, in a way, tie in with some of the stories that we're going to be talking about some bigger opera companies and what's going on there. So I think we'll get on to our stories now. And one story that came up this week, which we already kind of discussed, but I thought it was interesting for some of the comments that it engendered, and then some other sort of offshoot stories that have happened since then. And the title of it is How Much Do Opera Stars Get Paid? This appeared in The Telegraph, the British newspaper, on November 3rd. Rupert Christensen was the person who wrote it. And in fact, it seems like it's a recycled story with some updated information. But he starts out by saying, I was fascinated to notice in a corner of the Metropolitan Opera's website the open admission that for the 2010-11 season, the top artist fee was $16,000 per performance. And he goes on just to remark that, you know, it's very rare for opera companies to reveal this sort of information. Something I thought was really interesting is he goes back to the 60s and he said, we may surmise that a boom in the 1960s, which saw fees rising as high as £50,000 a performance on mainland Europe, collapsed in the mid-1990s. So obviously, things haven't quite kept up the 1960s levels. And, you know, he points out that, of course, you know, this may seem like, you know, a lot of money, but a lot out of those sums, singers have to pay living expenses in a foreign city, they have to pay off their agents, et cetera, et cetera. Some of the comments, just to quote a couple of them really quickly here, point out that, you know, in fact, the people that are making this kind of money is a very, very small sector of the singing population. One guy sort of said something like fees in smaller opera companies can be something like, you know, £300 a performance. And another ex-singer, I think his name is Sam McElroy, sounds like he was, doing pretty well at some point in the last few years. He said, for example, 5 weeks rehearsal at Opera Ireland will give you, for four performances, will pay you about €1,500 a performance. And then he quotes, you know, his fees at another opera company in Denmark, where he was only paid £500 a week. And I thought one more quote here before we get into a discussion, maybe a slight disgruntled singer, I don't know, said that this opera world, which you are so quick to snark about, is buttressed on the backs of thousands and thousands of singers who have no chance of making the sums you quote. So I don't know. What do you guys, what was your reaction to this story?
In relation to what sports figures made, mm-hmm. when we're talking millions of dollars for a contract, what does it matter what they're paid?
It's a good question. I think that often comes up. I mean, but people seem to, I don't know, balk at these numbers when they see $16,000 per performance.
But I do remember any of the opera singers I've ever interviewed, I've interviewed some really big ones, they're responsible for their own upkeep in whatever city they're in. Mm-hmm. They've got to pay their food, their transportation, so they are, if you're for 6 weeks in a city, let's say, given your rehearsal and your performance run, you're spending a lot of money. Generally, you want an apartment with a kitchenette so you can, make your own meals if you want to. And it's quite a lot of money. Like if you're living in an apartment in New York for 6 or 7 weeks, that's a lot of money. So I don't begrudge these salaries at all, because in no way do they compare what other celebrities make. I think the only comparison is maybe dancers, and dancers would be a lot less. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's also a power law distribution. I mean, the number of people up there making even the sort of, you know, the $15,000 a performance, and they only get that when they're singing at the Met or Bayerische Staatsoper or so on. You know, so I mean, if you figure it out and then you knock off expenses, you could figure out that a real superstar, recording contracts aside, might be making $300,000 or $400,000 a year for a superstar. I mean, which is, you know, less than a bog standard medical oncologist makes in Toronto. You know, to put it in perspective.
Yeah.
And then for that few dozen people making that kind of money, there are literally hundreds who are probably netting $50,000 or $60,000 a year, if they're lucky.
If you're in a Broadway show, your hotel is covered.
Well, I've always found the expense thing in opera quite bizarre. As you know, somebody who used to travel on business all the time. I mean, I spent, you know, I've had years when I spent 200 nights in hotel rooms. The idea that it wasn't paid for would just seem quite ludicrous, you know.
It's very hard, isn't it, to decide. I mean, just if you try and think about the question in the abstract, I don't, like, I guess the rest of you, I don't begrudge them what they get. And I think, you know, the real issue probably is, as John says, I mean, most people are not getting that, even if they're working, this kind of figure. But it's an interesting question. How do you, I mean, you can quantify how much it costs to, you know, buy a GAM, take coachings, rent an apartment, buy food and so on. But, I mean, how do you quantify, how do you put a price on, say, Eva-Marie Westbrook giving a fantastic performance of Lady Macbeth at Mansansk? I mean, there's this kind of mysterious thing, and to a degree, it's kind of, there's a certain amount of, magic, picking numbers out of the air seem to come into this, because nothing ever seems to be relative to what they're actually doing.
Okay, well, how do you quantify a forward on a hockey team?
You can't. Or how do you justify, you know,
you
somebody who
can't
act worth a damn getting paid millions and millions
yeah,
of dollars
no, exactly.
for a really bad Hollywood
yeah.
movie?
Yeah. And underneath this, though, there are real pressures on this. I mean, as you know, Peter Gelb this week.
We're going to talk about that, but yeah, bring it. Feel free to bring
it
up.
Well, bring it up. I mean, is asking Met singers to take a cut, and
yeah.
I think someone else has done that this week as well, John Marco.
Yeah, I was just going to bring it up. Well, so yeah, Peter Gelb sent a letter on Wednesday of this week to soloists asking them to cut their pay up to 7% to match the reductions that the Met's chorus and orchestra agreed to already, and the fact that also the Met laid off 22 of its full-time staff. And then just this morning, I found a story that David Poutney, head of Welsh National Opera, sent a letter similarly to all of his soloists, you know, and he is saying that, you know, their funding from the Arts Councils of Wales and England, they've been given what they call in-year cuts. So that is cuts to budgets that were already sort of established. So for singers who are even already contracted to sing with him, he's asking them to take a 5% reduction. Mm-hmm. And he says, and on the whole, you would probably prefer that we are able to continue with projects at a slightly reduced rate of reward rather than abandon them altogether. And, you know, I mean, these are voluntary. It's up to singers if they want to do it. He's saying you can pull out of your contract if you want to. But I just, you know, within a week, two major international opera companies are asking their singers to do this.
Well, it's because, let's face it, singer fees are part of labor costs, and it's probably, for most companies, one of the largest component of their expenses, and they're all under pressure to reduce them.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate. I mean, I'm not justifying it in any way. It's a kind of unfortunate that, you know, the discussion goes on about, you know, someone taking a 7% cut to a $17,000 performance, you know, salary. I mean, that's one thing, but then if you're at a much lower level than that, taking pay cuts is much more serious. And it really, there are other pressures, it seems to me. I mean, we have no shortage of, you know, young artists coming out of schools who want to pursue professions as professional singers. Supply and demand, there's a huge supply. And so,
I wonder about how responsible the universities and conservatories are being churning out the number of singers and musicians that they do, given the employment prospects. I mean, I know they're a business too, and, you know, they're raking in the fees and the rest of it, but I don't know.
Well, I mean, I know of schools, I mean, I'm not going to name them, but I mean, and I'm sure this is happening everywhere, where they're actually increasing their intake into vocal programs.
Of course.
Because the universities are so strapped and need fees.
Yeah, I know.
Exactly.
I know.
And the first year of an arts program covers the fees or the shortfalls in the second, third, and fourth year. When you cut after the first year, your least talented people aren't invited back for the second year. I know for a fact, because this was a great brouhaha that happened at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, that a bunch of undergraduates took the university to court because they said, we auditioned, we were thrilled to get into, you know, Carnegie Mellon, only to find out that we of the huge first-year class were never intended to be invited back to the second year.
Yeah,
and so our fees were paying what was happening to the upperclassmen. And I mean, if you go beyond that, the arts councils are cutting money right, left, and center. I mean, that's like,
well, that's what seems to be happening in Wales.
Yes,
know?
So
it's certainly happening.
Well, and also, as we have another story came up,
yeah.
It's happening in England too. I mean,
yeah,
English National Opera.
The thing that strikes me too is, I mean, the Gelban Pountney letters relate to signed contracts.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, you wonder what's happening with the ones that are being negotiated, that
now
are still being negotiated,
yeah,
because I bet we're not talking 5 or 7% beyond what people are getting right now.
Yeah.
And certainly I've heard from Canadian singers that certain Canadian companies are really putting screws on fees. I'm not going to name names, but
I think Wayne is right. It's, you know, when you're making $17,000 is one thing, but if you're being paid $1,500 a performance at a decent smaller company in any...
Or scale.
And
just equity scale.
Yeah. Well, I don't even know what that is.
No. I don't know what scale is, because it seems to change week by week. And depending on the show.
Yeah. But it's pretty sad.
Well, I mean, it's certainly seems to be a sign of the times in a way. Again, another story that we've already discussed, but I thought we'd bring it up again because it's a different group today, are the troubles at Rome Opera. And, you know, as we discussed, I think the last podcast, they've decided, like, in order to sort of keep things going there, that they will have to let go of their full-time chorus and orchestra, and then they're hoping to, the idea is to rehire them then, I guess,
on contract,
so that, you know, they probably don't have to pay them as many benefits in that. Although, this latest story that is from November 10th, that New York Times, by Rachel Donadio, seems to indicate that maybe they're pulling back from that, or that this the chorus and orchestra are threatening to strike, and so they may have to, like, come to some kind of deal. But one quote here from Carlo Fuertes, who's the general manager of Rome Opera, he said, he's acknowledging that the system there no longer works, and we kind of touched on this in the last podcast, the system of patronage, where people are given jobs, you know, for whatever reason, you know, they're doing them a favor. And he says, over time, the difficulties were resolved by opening the purse strings, meaning, I guess, government, you know, sort of help. But now, as we say in Italy, the knots are hitting the comb, he added, using an expression that translates as the chickens are coming home to roost.
Yes.
When companies have to start dismantling the very backbone of what makes them a company,
well,
actually.
Yeah, yeah. Yes and no. In that case, I mean, I think Rome in this case is kind of a special case in the sense that it has much bigger financial problems. I mean, I think, you know, reading the background on this, I mean, it has a budget of about, like, an annual budget of about $67 million or something,
mm-hmm.
and of which $50 million comes from the state, and so it's in an artificial situation, and quite why it thinks the state can maintain that kind of level, or why the organization does, I mean, is beyond me. But the other thing, I think last year they lost $30 million nevertheless.
Mm-hmm.
So they have deep, deep problems. And if they actually followed this through and actually rehired everybody on a contract basis, then actually they'd probably be doing something which is fairly standard here in North America anyway. I mean, how many companies actually have full-time orchestras?
Or full-time chorus.
Or full-time choruses, exactly.
Yeah,
most of them are actually operating on that contract basis.
Yeah, if you're a freelance person, they don't have to pay you benefits.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's
so
right.
They're saving tons and tons of money.
Well, and also
yeah.
it means you don't have to pay the chorus for the production, so the chorus doesn't appear in.
Yeah.
but what got me, actually, kind of buried away in the small print in that article, is that the orchestra and chorus are only a third of Rome's labor costs.
Yeah.
So two-thirds of the labor costs are other stuff. And I've read enough and heard enough from singers about what happens in Italian opera houses to know exactly where that other two-thirds of the money's going. You know, I mean, they pay people to stand there with props and hand them to singers because the singers can't be allowed to take them from the prop table themselves. They pay people to stand there and open doors for singers' entrances because you can't allow a singer to open the door themselves. You know, I mean, I hate to say this, but I think the Italian opera houses are getting what they deserve, frankly. I mean, they've been mismanaged, grossly mismanaged for so long that, you know, Yes, the chickens were.
I like the other phrase. What was
the when the knot hits the comb.
Oh, right, when the knot hits the comb. That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like
there's,
painful.
There's obviously somebody who's tried to comb my cat.
Yeah.
And has gone away bloodied.
Well,
but the Rome, I think. I mean, I actually lived in Rome, and Roman people really didn't support the Rome opera.
That was that came up in the article too.
And
yeah.
I mean, it Rome never ever ever figured as prominently. If you Italian, the history of opera.
Yeah,
La Scala's there. The Naples opera is
La Fenice.
Yeah, La Fenice. But the Rome opera never really had the cachet that other houses do, and it's the capital of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So you think they would be it would be a huge contributor to Italian opera history, and that's just not the case.
Well, I mean, women weren't allowed on stage there until after 1800. I mean, that's part of it. So you don't have that really deep tradition that you have in Milan and
but
Venice
even
and
composers,
Naples.
You take someone like Verdi, if you know, they all kind of dismissed productions at the Rome Opera.
Yeah.
Like nothing really premiered at the Rome Opera.
But until unification, Rome
didn't
was
really
a provincial
exist.
Was
that's
a, was 1867.
I mean,
was a provincial backwater dominated by the church.
That's
I mean the cultural center was Milan. Well, and
in
to an extent
Austrian
Naples.
Empire,
and to an extent Naples. Yeah. So I mean, you know, Rome is kind of like the Ottawa of Italy.
I'm so sorry to say that. I was thinking that. Like, well, yeah, we have this on a much lesser scale. I mean, it's a similar thing here that, you know, Ottawa has never had that.
No, I mean, it's places like Ottawa and Canberra.
It's the same
and,
with Bonn
you know,
as well. In
Bonn,
right.
The
right.
Capital moon.
Brasilia.
Brasilia.
Yeah.
All of those artificial capital towns.
On the other hand, how do you explain the fact that Ottawa has the greatest dance series, maybe in North America?
That's pretty anomalous. Yeah.
Four different series. I just was in Ottawa to see Peanut Bausch. I'm finding I'm in Ottawa maybe two or three times a year, and I wish I could go more because of the companies that
that's
come there.
That's interesting.
So is it that they had a forward-looking producer of dance when it first opened? Now there're three people down the line because other people retire, but how can you explain? Or their theater company is right up there with top directors, both the French and the theater.
That's true,
and
actually.
The English theater
that's
have
true.
Really strong directors, so how can you explain that Ottawa has an outstanding theater and dance series, you know? But you know,
opera.
The orchestra. How can we ignore the orchestra at the NAC, albeit a small one?
Mm-hmm.
You know, they just had this tour of China. So, like, Rome doesn't even have any of those cachets. You know, like the orchestra, the theater, or dance. Even the Rome Opera Ballet just.
Right. It has the Santa Cecilia Orchestra.
Yeah,
there,
okay, there's
it?
That.
So, yeah.
And the opera does take place there. And the opera
so
uses that.
That's probably the best part of it, actually.
Yeah. Tony Papano.
Yeah.
Well, oh gosh, this is like gloom and doom stories about opera companies in Europe. But another thing that sort of came up this week was the English National Opera. Now, earlier in the summer, they were dealt a 29% blow, a cut from the Arts Council of England. And I think we're starting to see some of the repercussions of that, in that they had big plans to put on a production of Monteverdi's Orfeo at Bristol's Old Vic Theatre. And I think this was very symbolic in that, you know, the English National Opera, in their title, they have this sort of national thing hanging around their neck. And this was supposed to be, like, you know, their first time out of London in 15 years. But they decided to, this week, cancel that production. And there's, you know, been some controversy about it. And then even though this is happening, you know, in another country, I thought it was sort of interesting because some of the comments were directed at, you know, should the money not be distributed differently in terms of our council money to allow for more touring? And I wondered, you know, the way things work here in Canada too. I mean, we're a much bigger country, but that whole thing of opera touring seems to have gone out the window. It used to happen in the 50s and 60s.
But that's because most of the big cities have some kind of opera presence
right.
of their own.
Yeah, but you could argue that about England too. I mean, there's a lot of opera companies throughout England.
Yeah, but
they're
concentrated in the southeast.
Yeah, they are. That's, I mean, there's Opera North. They're Scottish,
and they are too.
And they do actually. Opera North is a particularly interesting company.
So it doesn't have a home.
It doesn't really have a home, so it goes around
Leeds,
about four or five
Leeds,
yeah,
places.
Yeah, yeah, around there. The thing about English National Opera, I mean, the Englishness of it wasn't so much to do with it to tour. I'm not sure it ever really had a very
no.
It had to do with the language that they chose to put the operas on. And I mean, this is it's regrettable, but I mean, if you have a 30% cut that you weren't anticipating, you know, something has got to go. And what the arts, it's not the Arts Council is spending less money in England, it's just that part of what they've done, actually, ironically, given the story, is take it out of London and put it into the regions. Mm-hmm. And it's almost what's gone from London is almost exactly what's gone into the regions.
Mm.
There's actually been a slight increase in overall funding from the Arts Council in England. So it's the London companies, and particularly ENO, that have lost it. And I don't know what to say to this. I mean, it's unfortunate, and I hope, you know, the Bristol Old Vic, you know, is now looking for another co-producer to
mm-hmm.
see if it can carry on.
Because in fact, the director was supposed to be the director who did the Klinghoffer talked about.
It was. Tom
Morris.
He
was supposed to be director.
Yeah, that's right. So, and Bristol Old Vic has a very strong reputation as a very innovative company, and so he may well find another partner.
How much does it cost to translate an opera into English, since the English National Opera only sings?
How much does it cost?
I wonder.
Well,
I wonder how big an expense that is in the.
I don't. Well, I mean, there are an awful lot of English translations they could
that
pick up, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how much they would pay for it. I mean, you know, they paid Andrew Porter to translate The Ring for them back in the '60s or something like that, and now have dumped that translation or onto their next one. So I don't know.
That was a good translation.
Oh, it is a good translation. It actually reads well if you just read it. So I don't know, Paul. I don't think it's a significant, itself is a significant cost. I mean, this is essentially what they're doing is cutting a production.
Right.
You know, and God knows, there are lots of companies around that have been cutting productions.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. There was actually another story about it this morning, but one of the comments, somebody pointed out, I guess, in Classical Music Magazine, I mean, and this is just literally somebody's comment about a story, but said that they were only saving £200,000 all round by cutting this production.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so that's, okay, it's a fair amount of money, but it's not a huge amount of money. So you have to wonder, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to say what the economics is.
I mean,
£200,000 for a new production.
That sounds awfully cheap.
It sounds awfully cheap to me.
Yeah.
It's not a small cast.
Well, no, I think what they were saying too is that, you know, all the singers and people who've been in contract for this will still have to be paid. That's what I was reading this morning, because you know, the contracts have already been signed. And that situation does happen, actually.
Yeah,
sometimes it's better just to go on and do the production.
So
I mean, ENO is a peculiar case because, I mean, they've been playing to half full houses now for years. I mean, they're saddled with a huge house, 10 minutes from Covent Garden.
Yeah.
And somehow have never quite, I mean, they don't have, what's the right word, the glamour quotient that the Royal Opera House has.
But I actually lived in London.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I worked on St. Martin's Lane.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And when I was in London, the ENO was known for daring productions, and that's what attracted people. One of the sexiest, most sizzling Don Giovannis I've ever seen was, and I've never forgotten it, that was many, many years ago, was at the ENO. So people who went to the ENO, and they tended to be younger, really got to see some really interesting and daring and provocative productions. That was what it was known for. Not so much that they were doing it in English, but that they had daring directors who were willing to move the boundary. I would say that the ENO was maybe one of the first places that started with auteur directors.
Certainly outside of Europe, I'd say.
Yeah.
But I mean, again,
but I think they still have that mandate. I mean,
and they still do that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I think
so. Why
really
the half houses then?
because the house is so damn big.
That's true.
I mean, what is it, 3,600 seats?
Yeah, and it's,
I mean,
not
it's,
that acoustically.
And it's
not
great acoustically.
Either, so.
I mean, you wonder whether they wouldn't have done better to stay at Saddle as well.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
And again, it's that inner West End sort of location that's fine if you live in central London, but again, if you live in the burbs, it's tough to get home after a show. And believe me, I've done it.
Well, I think we'll end on it. We'll come back to North America for a bit now. We've been in Europe for a while. So this was just a little story that came up, and I just thought it was interesting, and I'd really like to know your opinion on it. So it seems that in Sarasota, the opera there has decided that perhaps one of the barriers for people coming to the opera is that operas are just too darn long. So what they've decided to do is to program Pagliacci, which you know, most of the time is paired with another short opera, usually Cavalleria Rusticana or another short opera, but they decided to make a program of just Pagliacci. There are going to be a couple of orchestral excerpts before it, and then a party afterwards where people can meet the artists and the singers. Yeah, they kind of did a informal survey. They phoned around a few other American companies that had tried doing Pagliacci by itself, and the response seemed to be somewhat positive, that our audience members at least didn't object to it. But just wondering, like, what you think of this. First of all, like, I mean, do you think that the fact that operas can be long is a deterrent? I just want to say, we were talking about this just at a meeting here at the COC the other day, and a couple colleagues said, my God, like, movies these days are so long. Like, these Hobbit movies that keep coming out are just endless. I mean, as long as an opera, and people seem to be willing to sit through that. Anyway, that's just an aside, but what do you think about this?
I mean, I think there's some truth in it. I mean, not so much in, you know, the show that you get in and out of the theater in 3 hours, but you know, when you put on Tristan or Valkyra or something like that, for people who work, going to see it on a work night is a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've got to get away from work early. You know, you're going to get home really late. You're going to get up again the next morning. I think those ones, you know, it's very different from the days when the people who went to the opera were, you know, largely people of leisure.
The leisure classes.
But I don't really see a problem with a show that gets you out of the theater by 10:30.
Yeah.
Beyond
11.
It's Canadian Stage, the theater company here in town, has now started 1 o'clock matinees and 7 o'clock evening performances. Mm-hmm. Because apparently their surveys told them that you'd like to go straight from work to whatever you're seeing, grab a sandwich in between.
Yeah.
I think they're seeing how that resets. So the latest you're going to get out is on an average 9:30 or something like that.
I actually like that. I mean, a lot of companies have moved from an 8 o'clock curtain to a 7:30 curtain.
Yeah, but this is a
and
7.
This is 7.
So
and I personally, I would totally go for that because, you know, for people who work downtown, you know, that 7:30, 8 o'clock thing is this kind of
there's a lot of time
really
between,
weird kind of downtime between.
And maybe you don't
want to
go out and
show.
Spend a lot of money on dinner.
Yeah, and then another thing, and I mean, think, you know, as you start to look at where people actually live in the GTA and the availability of public transit and when the GO train runs and all that kind of stuff, you get into the same situation as London, where people have to get out of the theater to get a train home. And if you can make that easier, I think you potentially expand your audience.
I have mixed feelings about this, or at least about the start times, because I still regret that it's 7:30 now, for example, at the COC and not 8 o'clock. And I know it sounds ridiculous, it's only 30 minutes, but the number of times I'm rushed to get to the theatre after work for 7:30 is, you know, annoying to me. I actually would prefer to have an early, I mean, a matinee performance, which of course is usually limited to the weekend. I love that you have one group of performances starting at 4 in the afternoon and you're out for dinner. I love
one.
That one.
I think that's Saturday.
But again, but it's a weekend only thing.
Right.
I think, for
the Broadway has midweek matinee.
They do.
They do on Thursday.
Yeah.
So I mean, I would like to have some more choices other than that. And I don't know about attention span. I mean, you have to remember Sarasota. It's a retirement or sunbird community. It's an older audience that comes in from you know, the condos, or, you know, they don't actually have far to go to get to the rather lovely theatre there.
Mm-hmm.
And let's not forget that Sarasota is the innovative company that actually has gone through the whole Verdi canon, so it's not...
That's right. This is
very much an experiment for them.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think if I were... If you offered me Pagliacci alone, I would feel kind of cheated and kind of think, do I really want to go to the effort of getting ready, getting there, just for over an hour of that? And I don't know.
But they have two acts, so if you have a fairly long intermission.
Yeah, I don't want long intermission. I get annoyed by intermissions because they get in the way.
My impression is that they're doing this all straight through.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think they're...
Yeah.
I mean, I must admit, I do feel a little bit cheated with some of the one actors.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, I fought my cash out for, you know, Iphigenie on Tauride, and it's over in an hour and a half,
yeah.
And I kind of feel like I didn't really get my money's worth. I mean, I noticed that, you know, when they did that in Brussels, they actually did double bill of Tauride and Olide.
Yeah. And then you really get your money's worth.
That is too long.
That's too long.
I agree.
The
Met used to do, I mean, Salome is usually done as one actor, and it's not much more than that. But I want to go back personally. There was in the late 40s, the Met actually did Salome and Gianni Schicchi as a double bill.
Oh, that's,
and I want to see them.
That's brilliant. Yeah. That's even better than the Florentine tragedy of Gianni Schicchi.
Yeah, no, exactly. I don't want to show them the evening scene.
You guys were into dance, your average, a full-length dance show is an hour. And that fits neatly into European presenters' festival mode,
right.
That it's an hour long. And that is what is considered a full-length dance piece is an hour. Nobody ever walked out of a dance performance and said, I feel cheated because it wasn't
Well, no, but that's because... That's what it is. I mean, that's what the culture is what you're saying, is that's the program.
But you wouldn't...
Most operas are not written to 1 hour.
That's,
I mean, that's
weird.
The thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
I think there's an expectation.
You wouldn't
yeah.
program a program at the National Ballet that was only an hour long.
No. No.
No, you wouldn't. You put two together.
A mixed program usually is three separate rooms.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that's the equivalent of what we're talking about.
Okay,
here,
but
right?
There's a whole world of contemporary dance that four times as big as the ballet world.
Mm.
Yeah,
and
well,
your average full length work is about an hour.
Well, I mean, it's like recitals are much shorter too. I mean, I don't think anybody would be up for a 3.5 hour piano recital.
No.
Anyway, interesting to see if like more companies.
Well, what I want to know though, are they actually reducing ticket prices for this?
You
that's
bet.
What
I didn't see that information.
Yeah, I would be astonished if they were, because I mean, it
probably
doesn't save you a whole lot, does it? I mean, you've still got to pay singers.
That's
you've
right.
You've
got
still
the orchestra.
Open the theater.
The theater's all there,
And there's probably minimum calls for the orchestra members, that kind of thing, for all the stage hands and that. I'm sure they're tied to that as well.
But are they doing it to save money overall, or are they actually doing it to try and attract a
This is an
audience
outreach type
thing.
Yeah,
it's
both,
actually, I think. But actually, it is an experiment to see how that goes.
I think it's an interesting experiment.
No, it is, and it'd be interesting to see what the results are for it, actually.
Well, what about Dido and Aeneas? Would you feel cheated if you...
I've actually usually it's done on its own as well.
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
I've seen it
done with a dramatization of Blow's Elegy for Henry Purcell.
Oh, okay.
Opera Atelier did that.
That's right. Yeah,
years
they
ago.
Did. They did, but that's rare. Dido
usually it's done on its own.
But Dido isn't normally done by like grand opera companies either.
Well,
I mean, you'd be surprised if you saw it on stage at the
Covent Garden did it a few years ago.
Yeah, did they do it on its own?
I don't know.
Yeah, they definitely did do it because Sarah Connolly was singing.
Because they did. I'm sure they did it on their own. It's when you think of Dido and Aeneas, you think of it. Honestly, but don't feel cheated if that's the only thing that you see.
That's fair.
Well, we'll see where this trend, if it is one, goes.
We're nowhere in trouble, actually, though, when they decide that actually it's not just a matter of one act operas,
right?
That they're just going to do the first act of something.
I hope I don't come across a story about that anytime soon.
Often happens in concert, right?
Oh, it does in concert, yeah.
Yeah, but it's usually there's still something on the program.
Besides it. Like one of
Valkyrie. So just to remind our listeners to listen to the podcast, there's several ways. You can visit COC Radio on our main webpage on the website of COC. Click on it there. The best way is, of course, to subscribe to it on iTunes. And if you do that, it will just be downloaded on your computer or personal device whenever there's a new podcast. And we always put up a post on Parlando, our blog, and I try to link to all the stories that we've discussed. And there's space there for your comments, which we would love to receive. So until next time, we're signing off from Toronto now, and we'll be back in a couple weeks.